You guys, I want to thank you for coming. We know this is a hike, and so but it's 10:30, and we're going to go ahead and start. My name is Jackie Meeks, and I work at Cook Children's Hospital System in Fort Worth, Texas. And beginning in 2008, we started a survey process of the community, and that's a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. So all of us are tied to the same hospital system. So I just want to thank my boss who kind of started this process. He's one of the senior VPs of strategic planning, and he really believes in getting out of the hospital and into the community. And then also one of our data analysts who always helps pull the data. So for my section, the objectives are really just to go through our survey process and how it's been refined every year and really talk about what we've learned. This is our third time to do the survey. We do it every 3 to 4 years, and so each time there's a little bit of a tweak to it. And then really just give you the opportunity, if anyone's interested in collaborations or using the tool, it's there for everybody. And all of us, we're all on the same side to say that we have no conflicts of interest. So a little bit about our system. Cook's has been around for a long time, since 1918, and we are a private, not-for-profit organization. So we're quite spread out. Although we have the main hospital with an emergency room and an urgent care, we also have community clinics spread throughout six counties, as well as individual doctor's offices who are part of our network. And we are one of the major employers within the top five or six for Tarrant County. Most of the hospitals are also major employees, but we're the only pediatric hospital in our six-county region. So one of the things that struck me in maybe the opening talk or someone on the first day is they said that not everyone can count on going to a hospital and being taken care of. And I'm very proud to say that any child that is brought to Cook Children's Hospital is taken care of, whether they have money or not. And as you see on the slide, not only do we have a huge annual economic impact just by those that we hire and services that we pay for in the community, we also give away actually more than $103 million. And that's a combination of free care that we give for those who cannot pay and we cannot get reimbursed for, as well as things that we sponsor in the community. So one of the things that draws me to where I work, whether it's any organization, is what they say they stand for. And I'm always very proud to say that we consider every child's life sacred. And I'm proud of that because we are not affiliated with a religious institution, but we do value children's lives. And the other part that I'm very proud of with our promise is that we put prevention first. We're not there just to treat the sick. We're there to help prevent illness in the community as well. This is our compass for the organization, what we say is our guiding North Star. And as you can see, the things that are important to us, first, child and family in the middle, because we realize that child does not walk in by itself. It does not live by itself. It does not shop for itself. It's the family component around it that we also have to take care of. But we also want to make sure that we are providing quality services. So to give you an idea of how this fits in the state of Texas, the blue part are our six counties. Just to the east of that is Dallas County's area, the counties right by Dallas County. And then the dark gray we receive referrals from. And actually, we get patients from across the country and across the world. But if you look at our six-county area, the Metro East, and our referrals, that's a lot of square miles. And the reason why that's significant is that that number of square miles is actually more than the state of New Mexico. So I'm actually in the Center for Children's Health. And here you see our goal is to collaborate to make North Texas a healthier place to live, a healthier place to raise your child. But our other goals in the Center for Children's Health are outreach. So we have a children's health research component, and we have a children's outreach component. The hospital chose top areas to deal with, and the bubbles are kind of, the size is important. So you see that asthma and weight are really huge bubbles, and those are two things we're investing a lot of time and energy into. And then you see dental. Dental is huge because in our hospital, one of the top surgeries is for dental care when the child's dental problems are so bad that they cannot be done in the dentist's office. They have to be sedated. So we know that there's a huge problem with dental care across our counties, even though we have dental clinics. And so we're working to try to reduce that. We're opening more dental clinics. We're combining them with the health clinics. But those are our six areas of importance. And we also just started a baby center, the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment, to deal with the abuse issue. So how does this play out, and why are those our six, and what does it mean? Well, for each of our counties, this graph kind of shows you what the population is and the amount of growth. So in the 4 years from when we did the first and second survey, our population grew, the children grew 11.3%. Between the survey we're doing right now and 3 years down the road in 2018, it will grow another 6.5%. So we have a lot of children in our area. Each of our counties, we asked them to identify what they considered a priority that they wanted to work on. And we fund community health managers or supervisors to work in that county with them. We have a coalition that they form from community leaders. And so this shows you what each county chose. So we have two who chose child abuse. So Wise County and Hood County chose child abuse prevention. Those are both considered rural counties. Parker chose child obesity as well as Johnson. And then Denton chose mental health. Denton has a university, and so it's quite large and more suburban. I think the thing to note, though, is that a lot of these people are mobile in their jobs and in their lives. So even though you see Johnson way down here and it's not counted as urban, a lot of those people will work or go to school or interact with Tarrant County, which is urban. It depends on where you live within that surrounding county, how much you really integrate with the more urban area. So to that end, the coalitions that we support in each of those counties, we really try to pull from the total ecosystem, and we try to get someone from each of these segments. Sometimes we're more successful than others. We have to say the county commissioners or the county judges who really have the power in those smaller counties have all been supportive. And usually if you can get your county judge and someone from the school, you're going to start pulling in others. So this is who we try to surround the children with. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit now about the CHAP survey. It was started in 2008 before it was mandated that hospitals do a community assessment. So we were a little bit ahead of on the curve of that. They administered it in 2008, 2012, and we just fielded the one for 2015. It went out in September of this month, and we'll collect through January of next year. So the date denotes when we actually get all the data in and it's cleaned and we start working on it. It's about 70 questions, but in actuality, when the person has to fill it out, it's much longer because those 70 questions often have A through H that you have to fill out. So it's a little timely. It's initially mailed out by mail. A couple of weeks later, we do hire a company. They start calling to say, have you returned it? If you're not going to mail it, will you do it by phone with us? Or would you like to go online and do it? So we get them back in several different ways. Only about 100 to 150 will be done by the internet. The rest, right now, it's about 45 mail, 55 by phone. The in-person comes in later when I do the last bullet. So we're different because we're looking at children 0 to 14. Most of the surveys are with older children or with adults. So even if you look at the behavioral risk factor survey, it's older children, it's not the younger population. And so that's really the bulk of who we have, although people can receive care from us into their 20s. But we're trying to fill that gap of what's missing about younger children. This is all from the parent or the guardian perspective. So what's lacking is we're not able to see if the child is saying the same thing. And we are going to the community at large, households that we know have a child in it. So they may not be our patient, but we want them to represent the community. But we can't match it up then to medical records. So it's just what that parent is telling us. We do also do special populations. We do the undocumented and the homeless. And that's where you really see that place matters. The whole healthography theme really came through for us because we're looking at urban, suburban, rural, homeless, undocumented. So we've really tried to cover the whole community. It's the same question in those subpopulations, but they are done face-to-face. And they are given a stipend. They're given a gift card of $25. Most of the undocumented for us in Texas is of Mexican origin. We have a few others, but I'm going to say 95 to 99% Mexican. For the homeless shelters, we have one shelter in particular that is women and children only, and so they really target there, but we do hit the other two main ones as well. And all of those are done orally. So here, kind of, I'm going to start with the overall lessons learned and then kind of back out. I really want you to think of your survey as either a piece of real estate that you're going to build on or a closet that you've got to put all your stuff in. Because we tend to want to cram more and more and more in, and there's only so much space before you start losing value or you can't find what you have or you've built this monstrosity that nobody wants to live in because it's just too tiny as far as individual space. And that's, in some ways, the beauty and the drawback of our survey. We tried to fit a lot on, but you have to consider when do you fit so much on that you don't get return on it. So one way that we tried to fit more on was a split design. And by that I mean every survey has basic questions, and then there are two versions. And one might ask more intensive questions about safety, or one might ask more about asthma or health access. So there's different pockets that aren't going across. And by doing that, you lose some of your power in some ways because you don't have the in staying the same. Your in is going to be reduced by half on some of those questions. I think the other thing, too, is when you have a survey and you're going to repeat it, you really want to look at ways to make it better. And sometimes people are hesitant to change because they say, well, if I take that question off now, I won't be able to look at it longitudinally. But is that question bringing you value? And if it's not, consider taking it off. Also involve others. When we first started this in 2008, they really went out to community leaders and talked with them. They went to partners they already had at the health department, school systems, community organizations, the academics, and kind of had a little team, a little committee about what do you think this survey should look like, what would you use from the survey, and that really gave a voice to a lot of what was put on there. The other thing that we learned from taking this out into the communities we serve and forming community coalitions and saying what would you like to work on is that what you might know from the data is a problem, when you include the community and ask them to lead, they may not pick what your expert thinks they should. And if you're really going to support them, you need to go with that and then find ways either down the road or when you expand to kind of work on some other issues that you know might have a higher prevalence. So, for instance, we have a county that picked a topic that really isn't a big problem for them, but they perceive it that way. And so we're working on it. And slowly but surely we're adding in some other things, tying it to the topic they picked to try to get out other messages. So momentum and a champion can take you a long way. My boss thought of this. He wanted to do it. He was the champion. He talked to the higher bees in the board, and he convinced them that it should be done. And he's been able to maintain that all these years because he hasn't dropped it. So find your champions in the community, in your organization, because they really can push open a lot of doors that you wouldn't be able to get through otherwise. And then report out and report often. So we do a big summit after we get the data back for the whole community. And then for each of the counties, we take a mini summit roadshow where we just go out and talk to that community about their county data. And so we want to report out and let them know so that they might find it meaningful as well. As many ways as you can share your data is important, whether it's through conferences or conventions or publications. You're the voice so that it has meaning and it has a life beyond just your organization. And then this is the part I really fall down on, and that's to celebrate. I think sometimes you're so used to seeing it. You see all the zits and the, you know, the potholes and the cobwebs, and you just don't realize that it has a value after a while. But you have to celebrate it because other people don't see those things. You know, we always pick ourselves apart without seeing the good. And so you have to celebrate your successes no matter how small you think it may be or the fact that you had to stay up three nights in a row to get that success. It's still a success, And you have to maintain that enthusiasm and that air of celebration if you want others to also realize the value. So lessons regarding those at the table. Everyone will have a preference. If I could do things by myself, I would definitely do things by myself. Because when you invite others to the table, you have to listen. Otherwise, don't invite them. You know, there's a reason why there's so many bands and there's so many circuses. Because you have variety and you have everyone at the table with a talent. And a lot of times a solo act doesn't have that. So invite them to the table, but be willing to listen and to be willing to consider what they're going to say. Don't ask questions if it's not going to be used. So for us, a large part of our first survey had clinical questions. Does a child have an iron deficiency? Does a child have diabetes? Is there an eye or vision problem? And we hardly ever use that data. And when we really looked out of the community, out of the 8,000 return surveys that we had, in between 2000 and 2012, there were only 78 diabetics. Tiny. And we didn't know if it was type 1 or type 2. So you really need tailored messages to those two different diagnoses for diabetes. So in this last version, diabetes was not asked. We didn't have a lot of kids with iron deficiencies, so that's not asked. So what I'm saying is, once again, it's like your closet. Don't keep all that stuff crammed in if you're never going to wear it. So, you know, that's a good way of just knowing what to weed out. After you've had a time or two, if it's not being used, don't keep it on. Some of our best suggestions have come from outsiders. So when we were looking for a question about food scarcity for this newest survey, there was someone at the health department who said, hey, I saw a great question on this other survey. You should use that. I had no clue about that other survey. So some of the best things come from others who aren't so tied to it. And then lastly, consider how it's going to be used by others. So people at UNT Health Science Center, some of the professors there have used our data set and published. The Tarrant County Health Department has used our data. There's a nonprofit tied to alcoholism who has used our data. So think, are there others who can use this to promote their cause as well as your own? So lessons learned regarding, because we've always done it that way. I don't really like the way most surveys ask race and ethnicity. And a lot of times we do it because if you try to tie something back to census data, you want to see how the census asked it. Or if a national survey did it, you want to see how a national survey asked it. And I think people get really hung up on our surveys because they have the ethnicity, you know, are you Hispanic, you know, heritage? And then below, they have all these other things, white, black, blah, blah, blah. And it didn't always mesh up the way it should when you start thinking about it. So this year, we still have that, do you have, you know, Hispanic heritage question on there, because other surveys have it. But along with the white, black, Asian, stringing them all out, we also have Hispanic and Latino to see how they're really answering. And are we having people saying Hispanic, Latino down here who didn't check it up above? And because I just think sometimes it's a question that we aren't really using. The other thing is sensitive questions. You're never going to get away from some sensitive questions. You will always have to ask income. But Gautham, who's going to talk later, really looked at sensitive questions that people either skipped or wrote, I don't know. And that's something that you also have to consider. If you have a face-to-face component, more people are going to skip the sensitive questions. It's bad enough to write it down that something bad has happened or you aren't making very much money. But when you have to tell that person face-to-face, it's even worse. And I always tell people, I know people lie, because when I get phone calls for surveys and they ask me if I live alone, I always say, no. Guess who's alone? When they ask me how much do you make, I never say how much I make. I make up a number, whatever I feel like that day. So I think I'm not alone in doing this. I think others do it as well. So although you're getting your data, really think about what it's saying. We have a lot of people on our survey where the household income is over $80,000, but their child is on free lunches. I think they answered correctly for the free lunch and said what they wanted their income to be. Or maybe their income was that, but now they lost their job. I don't know. But sometimes it just doesn't match up, but you have to accept it. That's what they reported to you. And then really think about the style of survey. More and more, I think, we ask the parents for their perception. I really kind of want to know the parents and the child's perception to see how they are matching up together. And although we don't do it, I think if you're going to do anything with clinical data, have a way of verifying. So in regard to how place matters, the first year the survey was done, we really didn't weight much on very many variables. They looked at county to get the townie proportion right, so that Tarrant County had the largest number, and you know, then it went by proportion down. But we really didn't look about at very many other factors, maybe a little bit with gender. I don't even know if race was really considered that heavily. But this last cycle, we're really trying to weigh it differently, to look at the county, the gender, the race, the income, so that you're really truly representative and not just hitting, well, it's sort of, you know, this is the biggest one, so we want to have the most people in that bucket. What we have found with Place Matters is that the urban, the rural, and the suburban, in most things we do not see a significant difference. And I don't know if that's because we're very mobile in Texas and lots of people have a car and you go in and out of towns or county lines all the time without even thinking about it. But for most things, we really didn't see a difference. Where we really saw a place difference, a healthography difference, was with the homeless and the undocumented. And that was huge, not only with income, but also with language, insurance, dental. Those were just all really big factors. So here are some specific things that we changed for this latest survey. I already talked about how we're going to handle Hispanic and Latino. But we wanted to know more about the household. We wanted to know if people were married or not married. We have a lot of grandparents who are answering this. The first one is mom and dad. The second large group that are answering this are grandparents. So we have a lot of kids who are not living with their parents. We wanted to know if, you know, there's a grown aunt and uncle living in the household too, that type of thing. We asked, does this child eat healthy meals most of the time versus typically eat healthy meals? Because what's typical? And even most of the time is really vague, but we wanted to get away from the word typical. We removed a lot of the clinical conditions. We added a question about discipline because of our new Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment. So do you spank? Do you do time out? That type of question. We reduced the breastfeeding question to one. We didn't have many on before, but it's something that really was not used, and it wasn't specific enough about breastfeeding. How many months? Did you do it solely? Blah, blah, blah. We didn't do all that, so we just really moved it down to one question. And then we asked about absenteeism from school. We didn't really have a good measure of that before. And then someone brought this up in one of the sessions earlier that I was in, and they were saying, you know, it's no longer just TV or computer. Now you have to think about the tablet and the phone for how much screen time a person has. So we included that in the question. And then also food scarcity. So here are just my final suggestions. Unless you have a true need, don't do a huge, long survey. Think about what you yourself would want to answer. If it's longer than you would want to answer, then why would you think someone else wants to spend that time? We don't pay the households to answer the survey. That's something our vendor wants to pilot with 100 people to offer them $5 to do the survey. And I don't really like that. I want people to do it because they want to do it, not because they're getting anything. So the shorter, the better. You'll get a higher response rate. Don't keep things in there that are just taking up room or junking it up if you're not really going to use it. Consider what's new and emerging and cutting edge. Scarcity is not new and emerging. For us, it's new and emerging. We hadn't really asked about it, but you're seeing more and more presentations on it. Consider the dignity of those who are going to answer the survey, and consider how you're going to share it in meaningful ways. One of the things that we handed out when you first came was a newsletter. So we have about 1,500 households that did the survey in 2008 and 2012. And so what I started doing in 2012 is sending a newsletter to them every 3 or 4 months. And I'm going to put these on a chair so that those of you who did not get it can get some. And the reason why I'm doing that is I want the households who took the time to give us information to also get something back from us. So it's very light and easy reading. We try to do a few facts, a few tips or helps for the parents. And then on the kids page, if they do that activity and return it to me, I send them something. It's usually something small. I probably don't spend over $10 on whatever it is I send them. Last time, it was a movie ticket. And sometimes I know how many kids are in the household because they'll say that, you know, my three brothers and I worked on this or whatever, and I get wonderful little notes from them. But what I'm hoping to build is a relationship so that they continue to do our survey until their kids age out. Here's our website, if you're interested. We know that kids 0 to 14 are just a fraction of the population, but they're 100% of our future. So next we have Amy Richards, and she's going to talk about how we compare to two national surveys.
Hello. Thank you very much for coming. My project was to take our CHAPS data from the four surveys that we had from survey years 2008 and 2012 and to compare those firstly with the National Survey of Children's Health and then with the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which also is known as NHANES. The objective here was to look at how our children in our counties of North Texas would compare both nationally but also statewide with Texas. I won't go much into the CHAPS background because Jackie already has. Yes, we had the first two surveys, 2008 and 9 and 2011 and 12. The public mailing list was restricted to those families that we knew that had children from infancy to age 14. It was mostly a combination of mail, phone, and the internet, and administered in both English and Spanish, or Spanish versions. The target goal for the response rate was 33, and in fact, the response rate that we received was 37%. The first national survey that we looked at was the National Survey of Children's Health. This examines the health of children from 0 to 17 years of age. So we restricted all of the data to just those children aged up to 14. Also, with this survey, the public use data set allowed us to subset to the state of Texas itself. This is wholly a telephone survey for U.S. households. It's a computer-assisted interviewing system. Their response rates, they call them the interview completion rates, in 2007 was 46.7%, 2011 was 54.1%. In 2011, they split the survey into calling landline phones and to calling cell phones. So here we can see they had a slightly larger response rate with landline phones at 54% and then 41% for cell phones. And Texas completion rate was 46% for 2007. The NHANES survey has been going on since the 1970s, 1976, I believe. It surveys both adults and children. It's a targeted, complex, multi-stage survey. So as we will see, the NHANES survey actually has a smaller sample size than either our survey or the National Children's Survey because their complex survey design allows for validation even with a smaller sample. Another feature of this survey is that they do in-person interviewing. This is a very costly method, but it allows them to have very high response rates, 87 and 89%, and they are also able to look at a smaller sample while still getting a very representative estimate of the national demographic. So here we have the first comparison across all three, and see that in the middle there, the national children's survey is split on the left into Texas, which is the statewide subset of the national survey to the right, and then NHANES is all the way to the far right. For our CHAP survey across the two survey years and the four different questionnaires that we gave out, there were 233 unique variables. For the National Children's Survey, there were over 300, and then NHANES is an incredibly complicated survey with over 1,500. So we had to find those questions that were comparable, mostly directly comparable, across all three surveys. So the first thing we looked at were the demographics across all three, and just looking at age and gender, you see that they break down pretty much similarly all the way across. Now with race and language, this is the first instance that we see a difference in the healthography and place that we that we're discussing. To the left, our CHAPS survey represents our communities. As you can see, our community is about 66 the survey has us as 66% white non-Hispanic, which is in keeping with the county survey data, the census data that was taken. Comparing that with the Texas statewide, you can see that the number of Hispanic families for the Texas statewide data increases almost over twofold from our CHAPS data to 49.3%. Also, we have a smaller representation of Black non-Hispanics in our survey than we do across the other three data sets. This is continued in the language spoken that we see, where our English-speaking families are 91%, and our Spanish is only 8.8%. The other surveys show much higher Spanish-speaking percentage than ours. With parental level of education, there are three categories here: less than high school graduates, and anyone who's had education beyond high school of any kind. Here, our families show parental education beyond high school of 83.7%, which is much higher than the other three. For family income, the National Survey of Children did not ask the income question, so we are comparing directly against NHANES. And again, we have an income bracket that is much more skewed towards the higher income end than the NHANES. However, NHANES specifically wants to target different socioeconomic levels to get a national picture of demographics. So the first health domain that we looked at was access to care. Within that domain, we were able to identify four separate health indicators to compare across the surveys. The first one was, does your children have a doctor whom he or she considers their primary care doctor? That is the table to the left. We just asked yes or no, do they have that doctor? And NHANES didn't ask that question directly, So we're looking only at the National Children's Survey. And we can see that our children have a doctor that they consider their primary doctor that they go to at a higher rate than either at the Texas or the national level. Then what we noticed was there was another question asked. So wordage on these survey questions is very important. The second question was asked slightly differently. Instead of asking, does your child have a primary care doctor, it was asked, does your child have a medical place, or what is considered a medical place for them to attend? And when our data is compared against the wording of medical place, you see that there is, in fact, no statistical difference, because access to care is sort of changing, where you may not have the same doctor that you visit each time, but maybe you have the same clinic or the same wellness center that you would see. Next, we asked about school days missed. And this was categorical data. And in order to compare across the surveys and be able to obtain a p-value, I went ahead and I got the mean of each of the categories. So we took the mean of the days that were reported. So for our CHAPS, it's the purple dot to the left. We see that our families reported roughly 1 to 5 days of school days missed per year. However, Texas, the state data and the national children's data were slightly higher in mean compared to CHAPS. And Haines is slightly less, but statistically not different from our CHAPS data. Next, we asked, on the left, we asked if your child saw a doctor in the past 12 months, yes or no. And we see that our families reported 95.4% of their children did see a doctor in the last 12 months, and lower numbers for the other surveys. And then to the right, we then asked, well, how many times did your child visit the doctor in those 12 months? And we see that our families reported a higher mean, higher than 2.3 days, 2.3 days. And the Texas, the National Children's, and the NHANES all showed decreasing visits to the doctor. So looking at the summary of access to care, we can ask, how is CHAPS sort of measuring up to the other surveys? It's very good that we are showing higher prevalence of our children seeing the doctor in 12 months. We're showing that our children missed the fewest amount of days of school, which was very good. Yes, our children saw a doctor during the past 12 months, and it's kind of difficult to interpret how many times a child will visit the doctor. Younger children will visit more often. Ill children will visit more often. So it could be a good thing, could be preventative, could not be. So it's difficult for this fourth one to really assess. Okay. For family activity, we looked at three separate ones. This one is minutes of TV or screen time watched. On the left is all ages, and we see the pattern where our CHAPS families show a reduced number of screen time, and then the other surveys are increased. And then less than 5 and greater than 6 years old, the pattern is the same. We asked about meals eaten in a week. And we see that our CHAPS families reported a mean of higher than 3.6 meals eaten together as a family. The National Survey of Children show a lower mean than that, and NHANES shows a higher mean. Whether or not someone smokes inside the home was asked. Again, our families had a prevalence of 11.8% smokers inside the home, which is higher than was reported for the Texas and the National Children. However, it was statistically on a par with NHANES. So for family activity, we see that our CHAPS children did very well watching very little television or being in front of a screen for the fewest amount of minutes. Because of different wording across the different surveys, it looks like most of the children had the same amount of meals eaten per week or eaten per day with their families. And CHAPS did report a much higher prevalence of smoking within the home, so that is probably something to work on. The next health domain is health insurance, and there were three different indicators under this domain. Here we asked, does your child have health insurance? And here we see our families reported 94% of their children having health insurance, which is higher than the other three data sets. This asked about health insurance gap in the last 12 months. Our children reported, our family said that 10.1% of the children had a gap in their health coverage in the last 12 months, which is on a par statistically with the Texas statewide data set, and it's a much higher number than was reported nationally. Next, we asked, what kind of health insurance does your family have or does your child have? National Survey of Children did not ask this question, so we are comparing only to NHANES here. And you can see that our children report only 17.0% is government coverage, which is in stark contrast to the government coverage seen across the nation. Our private insurance is at 82.5%, which is much higher than the national of 55.2%. So looking at the summary for health insurance, it's very good that our CHAPS families are reporting higher rates of health insurance for their children. However, we also have gaps in their coverage. And the kind of health insurance that the children are covered by is different slightly than what is reported nationally. Next, we have mental health, and there were three indicators here. NHANES did not ask this question. Our question asks the parent for a more subjective, does your child have behavioral developmental problems outside of what you consider typical? However, the national survey asks if the child needed counseling, which infers a medical professional had asked or recommended counseling for this child. So it's slightly more objective data. So keeping that in mind, we see that our CHAPS families do respond higher that yes, they consider their children to have behavioral or emotional issues at a higher rate than either the statewide or the national survey children's health survey. Does the child have mental illness was asked by all three surveys. If you note, the NHANES survey asked if the child has actually then seen the counselor or doctor, as opposed to whether or not they just got a diagnosis. But even with the different verbiage of the questions, you can see that there's no statistical difference across the four data sets. Next is, does the child have a developmental delay? Only CHAPS and National Survey of Children asked this question, and our survey was on a statistical par with the national, but the Texas-wide did show a lower number. So for mental health, we have our children who are reporting, our families who are reporting children with more behavioral or emotional developmental problems. Mental health illness prevalence is equivalent across all of the different surveys. And then whether or not a doctor has said that the child has a developmental delay was higher in our CHAPS families. Finally, we come to physical health. I'll go through this faster than this looks. First, we asked our parents, how do you consider your child's health, which is obviously a very subjective question, and 86.2% responded excellent and very good, which is a much higher it's a much higher frequency than the other three, which is very good to know. Physical limitations. Our families report a lower percentage of their children with physical limitation challenges than was seen in the National Survey of Children's Health, either Texas-wide or nationally, but we are on the statistical par with the national number reported by NHANES. The questions about asthma were worded slightly differently from one another. On the left, we asked, has your child ever had asthma? And with that wording, we have a higher response of parents saying their children has asthma. On the right is, does the child currently have asthma? And we can see that if the child currently has asthma, actually our families are more statistically similar across all of the surveys, except for the National Survey of Children, which is slightly less. For diabetes, there were very few respondents, obviously, for diabetes, but you can see that our CHAPS families and our Texas statewide families are statistically similar with one another and considered slightly higher than both of the national. And finally, we have allergies. The column to the left is all of the categories of allergies, and then skin, respiratory, and food going out to the right. The take-home message from this one is that our CHAPS families report a much higher prevalence of allergies in their children, regardless if it's the overall category, skin, respiratory, or food. Ear infections. The wording was quite different. Ours was asking, did the child ever have ear infections? The National Survey of Children asked, just during the past 12 months. So that alone you can consider it's going to have a much lower prevalence, and that's what occurred. So for physical health, we can see that our children, our parents report that our children have a much better general description of their health being excellent and very good. The data for asthma and diabetes and allergies and ear infections all seem higher in our CHAP survey. And our final tally, when we look at our CHOP survey in comparison with the other three, actually our questions were the most statistically similar to the national NHANES survey, with 8 out of 23 questions being similar to one another. Then we were next similar with the Texas statewide and most dissimilar with the National Survey of Children's Health. Thank you very much, and now Gautam.
I would turn this in saying that Amy's a student at the University of North Texas. She's going to graduate soon with her master's from the Department of Biostats and Epidemiology. Gautam's a recent grad from the University of North Texas in the same department.
Hello.
Sorry. And there's a sign-in sheet. If you've just come in, whoever has it, if you would just pass it around again, that would be great.
Hello. Good afternoon. And, well, like you said, I'm Gautam Ganta. I'm working as a clinical task programmer in New Jersey. And so we, as researchers, always concentrate on our participants' responses, I mean, what our participants are telling us, to assess the success of our intervention or the study, whatever we're doing. And I think just as how duality exists in life, we should also look at what our participants are not telling us. Like, are they missing certain questions more often than others? And so that's what I looked at. And we know that most surveys have missing responses, and people tend to skip a certain kind of questions more often than others. And these questions happen to be sensitive, have been identified as sensitive questions. And questions usually about drug use, sexual activity, voting, household income are generally considered sensitive, and people tend to skip these questions in particular more often than others. And people tend to respond by providing answers such as, I mean, they might say don't know, or they prefer not to provide, or they just completely skip that question. And this might be because of concerns regarding disclosure of information, and especially when they're reporting illegal and socially undesirable behaviors. And so the aim of this project, So I worked on the CHAPS 2012 version 2 of the survey, and during the summer of 2013 as part of my practice experience. And so the aim of my project was to explore the proportion of non-response to these certain sensitive questions in the version 2 of 2012 data and identify if there are any predictors present. And so these 11 questions are sensitive questions which I've identified from the version 2 of the data set. The version 2 of the data sets, and they range from household income through parents talking to children about drugs and alcohol, sexual activity, through whether the child has ever been pregnant or the child had sexually transmitted disease, and then they also cover all the questions related to abuse and neglect. And I also looked at the amount of non-response among all the questions in the survey. So these, and I've considered the responses such as don't know, or if they are prefer not to provide, or not provided. So what I considered was that there was always yes or no. There are only two responses. And there are only people, if they say don't know, I mean, they truly might not know, or they just didn't want to provide us that information. So I went ahead and I clubbed all of them as non-response. And so these 5 questions had the most non-response in the overall survey. And the next slide shows the non-response percentage for those 11 questions which we've just seen. So if you look at the household income, that by far had the highest non-response, which is about 13.83%, followed by the question on the child having an STD, and followed by those two questions where they asked the respondents whether they talk to their children about sexual activity and drugs and alcohol. And so these were the predictors I was looking at. the age of the child, the ethnicity of the child, the respondent's relationship with the child, and the respondent's level of education, the county they reside in, and the method they completed the survey. And so I've used logistic regression for analysis purposes, and I dichotomize the responses into non-response and response. And so this particular table shows the odds ratio. I'm sorry that it's a little too much, but so this is the only way I thought it depicts, displays everything in it. So this table shows the odds ratio estimates, and all the values highlighted are statistically significant. And if you look at the child's ethnicity, like and look at the third one, which is Asian. So we've noticed that Asians were almost 5 to 8 times more likely to not respond. Let me correct it. Respondents who identified their child as Asian were 5 to 8 times more likely to not respond to questions related to CPS investigations, physical abuse, neglect, and so on and so forth, compared to the Caucasian population. And respondents who identified as other as relationship to their child. I mean, the others consisted of foster parents, guardians, step parents, and siblings, everybody else. And if you look at that, we see that they're almost 8.85 times through 18 times more likely to not respond to questions than abuser. Whether the child has been psychologically abused or mistreated, and then whether the child has been taken to a family violence shelter, so on and so forth. And so a comment regarding that 18 times more likely is that they might really not know, because if they're the foster parents or the guardians of that child. And when we looked at the respondents' education, it seemed to be least predictive. And so when looking at the county they reside in, we've noticed that the Hood County, which is a rural county, so they were almost 3 to about 8 times more likely to not respond to questions on abuse. And Hood County is one of those counties which have identified as child abuse as their main problem, which they need to work on. And for some reason, they still are not open about it. Sorry. So what we found is that, as seen in this table, so the county the children reside in, and the child's ethnicity. Oh, and I also forgot. So the method they completed the survey also did matter. So we looked at the respondents who completed the survey over the phone were almost 15 to 33 times more likely, 15 times more likely to not respond to a question asking about whether their child has an STD compared to the ones who completed it online. And they were 33 times more likely to not respond to a question asking whether their child has ever been pregnant compared to those who completed it online. And the county they reside in, or the place they reside in, and the child's ethnicity were more predictive were more predictive of this non-response. And like I just said, the respondents who identified their children as Asian were more likely to not respond to questions on pertaining to their child abuse neglect compared to those who identified their child as Caucasian, and that's about it. And in conclusion, in conclusion, identifying these patterns of non-response help us understand our target population better, and also understand what information is being perceived as sensitive. And it will also help us reword and reassess our survey instrument continuously. So future steps for this project, I would say that to check the interactions between child's ethnicity and the respondent's level of education, and then perform further analyses to confirm the findings. And my recommendations were to extend these analyses to both versions of the data, and even look at the 2008 version also, if there are any patterns existed, and if there was any change observed between 2008 and 2012, and check for interactions, and also simultaneously tailor the questions for the next versions of the survey, and repeat this analysis after every cycle so that the survey is correct and most apt the time. And these are my references. And thank you, and I'm going to hand it over to McKinsey. She's going to talk about what
So McKinsey Cutchall was in my first group of interns from University of North Texas, and she hung around after she graduated, and she would still come into the office every day, and we ended up hiring her. And so she's now a data analyst in our health systems department. And McKinsey works on a lot of data beyond CHAPS, so she's kind of become familiar with not only our survey and community side, but also our clinical side and our strategy as well. So I'm just going to repeat, there's a sign-up sheet if you haven't signed it. Keep it floating around. I also handed out a little newsletter that we send out to our parents who've completed the survey a couple of times, and so I have a few more of those. If you didn't get one, Gautam can hand you one.
Like Jackie said, my name is Mackenzie Cutchall, and I work as a decision support analyst in Cook Children's Healthcare System. So I'm going to be talking today kind of about the factors that we're finding that influence how parents rate the child's overall health, which is a question that Amy talked a little bit about. So the question that we use to assess general health is how, they ask the question, in general, how would you describe this child's health? And it's rated on a scale from poor to excellent. And in the 2012 household population, we saw 56% of parents rated their children's health as excellent, and 87% were excellent or very good. So I think it was last summer when I first started, Jackie was wanting to look at how all of the other factors in the survey are kind of influencing how a parent would describe their child's health. And so literally what we did is pick through every factor and kind of dig into how those factors were driving the overall health of the children. So the methods that I used, I just used the 2012 household survey population for that, and I dichotomized that general health question into excellent and very good, and good, fair, and poor. I started with a bivariate analysis using a chi-square with each variable categorizing them where meaningful for association with that binary outcome variable. Then I sort of moved into a multivariate analysis with the ones that were significant from bivariate, and I did a stepwise logistic regression, kind of keeping it into our sections in CHAPS. So I looked at all the physical health variables together, I looked at all the mental health variables together, things like that. So today, I'm not actually going to take you through that entire analysis. It would take the rest of the day, but I'm going to focus on what I thought were some of the most meaningful results that came out of it, and that was the demographic factors and the physical health factors. So in demographic factors, the significant predictors that I found were household income, parent education, race, and whether or not the child receives free meals at school. That really wasn't surprising to me, but it just kind of really hit home how important those socioeconomic factors really are. And what I thought was really interesting is some of the factors that I thought would be significant, and they weren't, was the relationship to the child, the person's relationship to the child, the person who answered the survey, the length of time that families lived in the community, the age of the child, and the sex of the child. Those factors had no influence, well, no statistically significant influence, rather, on how the parent would rate the child's overall health. In the physical health section, I saw significant predictors were asthma, and we have two questions that we use to assess whether or not a child has asthma. First one is, have they ever been diagnosed with asthma? The second one is, do they currently have asthma? And both of those were found to be significantly associated with that outcome of general health. Allergies were also a significant predictor of how the parent would answer that question. And a chronic physical condition which limits activity was significant, and also the BMI. And I think, I mean, we have a ton of physical conditions that we assess, and as Jackie mentioned, you know, they go down to even minuscule things like low iron, where we have really small numbers. And these are very noticeable things, I think, to parents. You know, if your child has asthma or allergies or a condition in which they can't be active, the parents are more likely to rate their health as lower. So, going back to that socioeconomic status, like I said, it wasn't surprising, because as I started to dig into literature, found that socioeconomic status is almost always, in all the literature I saw, it always was, linked to a wide range of health problems. And it's traditionally been defined by education, income, and parents' occupation. And as you saw, both parent education and income were very significantly associated with how they would describe a child's overall health. So this research that I was looking into goes all the way back to the 70s, and I looked at a study by Michael Marmot in 1978, and he developed what's called the social gradient. It's a relationship between health and social class. And he looked at how it's not just a dichotomous relationship where, you know, in poverty you see low, in non-poverty you see higher. He described it as a ladder. As you move up the ladder and down the ladder, you're seeing a gradient of health. And then I also looked at a model by Grossman in 1972, and that was based actually on economics. And as a health economist, they looked at different factors that bring value to health as inputs, and then as outputs, kind of a monetary cost on what we're seeing in healthcare. And so his research was on that equilibrium, you know, if we put in the right inputs, are we going to have less cost on the output? So some of those inputs are not just medical care or even preventive services, but they go as far as food, housing, family structure, safety, safe places to play. So we kind of try to capture things like that in the chat section, because not only do we ask physical health questions, we also ask mental health. We ask access to care and insurance, but also safety in your community. Are there organizations? Are there parks in your neighborhood? Are there grocery stores with good food? And then we ask parent profile questions, you know, different things about the family activity, what they do, does the parent smoke? A lot of people mention those questions. So really what we're trying to get at is the child's health as a whole and not just medical conditions. Okay, I thought you couldn't see it because you can't see it on here. But the other populations that we surveyed look a lot different than the general household population that we surveyed. So our special populations are our homeless, our undocumented, and then our patient population, which is patients of our hospital. And I just did this analysis in 2008 because we didn't survey the patients in 2012. So our homeless population, our surveyed population is a lot smaller. We have an N of 165, and those are parents of children 0 to 14 who are living in homeless shelters. Once again, those were surveyed both years, and that was a face-to-face survey interview. Our undocumented parents are undocumented parents of children, again, ages 0 to 14, surveyed both years. We have an N of 185, and that was also face-to-face. So our patients are parents of children who had been patients at our medical center the previous year. They were only surveyed in 2008, and that was a paper survey, and we had a little over 1,100 respondents for that. A limitation to that population is that we can't match those surveys with their clinical data. Even though they were patients, we didn't identify them that way. So we don't know at the time the survey was answered what they were in the hospital for, which obviously may affect how a parent would rate their overall health. So what does that general health status look like across those four populations? So this is 2008, or before I had shown you 2005 or 2012, but you can see that our household population is the highest in ranking their children's health as excellent. The homeless, it goes down. Undocumented parents, only 30% are rating their child's health as excellent, and patients were 34%, which is to be expected. They are in the hospital, so I would think that would be a little bit lower than your general population. So what I wanted to look at next is how in those special populations, those key factors that I had identified, how do those look different in our special populations? So our household survey, 2/3 of our population is white, but if you look at our undocumented population, nearly 100% is Hispanic. In our homeless population, we are seeing 42% black, and our patient population is a lot more similar to what we're seeing with our general household survey population. In parent education, we can see that 59% of undocumented parents have less than a high school education, and 56% of parents in our household survey have a four-year college degree or higher. So there's high educational attainment in our household survey. And 38% of parents of our patient population also have a four-year college degree or higher, and 34% of homeless parents had a high school degree, and 35% actually had some college. Where I'm seeing the most diversity, I'm sorry, this is a terrible graph, but the categories were so different across our four populations that to really capture it, I had to include so many. So we're seeing, which income is obviously a huge indicator of socioeconomic status, and across our four populations, they are extremely different. So what we always find when we look into our household survey is that we get kind of an oversampling of the higher income levels. And once again, it is parent reported, or so you get that what Jackie was talking about is a sensitive question. We are relying on what they say, you know, to have their income. But we saw that 36% of our household survey population actually reports a household income over $100,000, and 60% is over $70,000. If you look, comparing that to our homeless population, you see that 84% of our homeless population is actually under $14,000. And for our undocumented, we're still seeing really low incomes, not quite as high in the, or not quite as large in the lowest category, but we have 85% under 28,000. And our patient population is the most diverse across the income categories. So I think as we look at these four populations, you can see that our household population rates their child's health as highest, and they're also in the highest socioeconomic class. And I think that it's important to know that socioeconomic status continues to be an extremely important factor when we look at children's health. And the research I was looking at goes so far back that this is not a new thing, and we're still continuing, you know, 30, 40 years later to see those same disparities. It's also very apparent that our household survey population is a lot different than the special populations that we surveyed. So that tells us that our surveys really, it's obviously not capturing homeless and undocumented patients or parents and families. So when we work on interventions and programs to target those populations, those really need to be tailored for their specific needs because they do look a lot different.